Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance on Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. Robert Knott is absolutely unique. Out of the University of California at Finkinlan, also called Santa Barbara, he did one of the hardest things you can do in research. He did brilliant research and then kept doing it. That is an extremely rare commodity in the racket. To say he's chairman of research affiliates barely describes his contribution to the Chartered Financial Analyst Program and to thinking out there about what to do and what not to do. Rob Arnott, thank you so much. And you know, someone's going to say you're bearish in that. Well, forget about that. What's the biggest mistake right now in a type 2 construct? What's the thing desperately not to do right now?
I think the most serious mistakes investors make are performance chasing. Whatever has done well, buy more. Whatever has faltered, shun it. And secondly, blinders, focusing strictly on domestic opportunities. I'm not bearish when things are cheap. Stocks outside the U.S. are reasonably cheap. Value stocks outside the U.S. are very cheap. And we find all sorts of narratives relating to China, relating to Ukraine, for not investing outside the U.S. But the U.S. is priced at more than twice the valuation multiples of non-U.S. stocks. And so to avoid those two mistakes, it's awfully useful to think in terms of forward returns, not past returns. And forward returns are simply a function of what's the yield, what's the historical growth in income,
right?
And if there's any valuation mean reversion towards historic norms, is that going to help you or hurt you?
Do you suggest that on a national basis, U.S. basis, or even international basis, that we're going to have a regime shift in what our interest rate will be that will allow for the fiction of a better nominal GDP, a better animal spirit out there, but in the long run won't pay off? Does Rob Arnott have to shift up from an anchored 2% to some kind of new interest rate regime?
I think we are in a transition from a failed experiment with near zero and negative interest rates. That effort to stimulate an already growing economy was beyond foolish. And I think we're seeing the beginnings of a regime shift back to a point where interest rates matter. Think of interest rates as a speed bump. If you have a speed bump on a street that's too high, it stops the traffic. If you have a speed bump that's non-existent, you're going to get the occasional reckless driver driving way too fast. And the same thing applies with interest rates. When interest rates are too high, the economy is shuttered. Interest rates now are back to some semblance of normal. People talk about Powell channeling his inner Volcker. Pardon me, Volcker took the short rate to 500 basis points above the preceding peak in inflation. Mm-hmm. Today, that would mean making the Fed funds rate 14%. He's not channeling an inner Volcker. He's dabbling with increasing rates in a fashion that hopefully won't do too much damage. And it's all based on a very naive neo-Keynesian view that you have to wreck the economy in order to rein in inflation.
Robert Knott, help me with the idea of my theme for 2023, which is if we get a normal rate regime, something many of our listeners and viewers have never experienced, let's say we get back to a regime of 16, 17, even 20 years ago, that we will see what I call the great zombie roll-up. And that there's all sorts of companies out there, domestic and international, that just aren't going to make it. How can you profit from that?
Well, you can profit from that by investing broadly diversified into markets that are cheap and will cushion the damage of those. You can avoid that damage by looking at quality metrics and not investing in companies that are highly likely to go bust. You can measure interest rate sensitivity for companies, and companies that have large debt, be very wary. Don't own them unless they're really cheap. And there's a lot of companies in the meme stock community that have huge debt. And as that debt gets repriced, they're likely to struggle. So the notion that high interest rates are going to hurt the value stocks is actually way too simplistic.
I look at one of the great quotes last year, something I think that you will appreciate. Nassim Taleb, always controversial, saying, well, the physics is back, the gravity's back in the equations. And you've certainly alluded to that. Rob, what I notice also is we've become addicted in our modern trading to bringing in our hold period of average investments from years into months, if dare I say, not even days as well. If we get the Taleb gravity, if we get the world you talk about, obviously, I agree with you. Are we going to learn that we have to have a longer holding period for our investments?
I think holding period should be a function of where your personal skill set is. If your skill is in short-term trading, I would never advocate that Ken Griffin take up the idea of bicycle investing. He's doing the rest of us a huge favor by trying to scalp a fraction of a penny off of every trade you make. It gives you great liquidity. And so focus on what you're good at. I'm focused on long-term. I'm a long-term investor. I want short-term investors to be there to provide the liquidity. And folks who are not good at short-term, but playing the short-term game, they're also providing liquidity, but they're likely to get badly hurt, and they often do.
Let me finish up, Rob, with the arch question. All my radar's up on this is I've got the usual active managers trotting out telling me this is the time for active to outperform, and many of them ascribe to your international view. Rob Arnott, an update on active versus passive, please.
I think the whole active versus passive thing is a complete distraction. Active managers, the passive managers own the market. That means that if you take them out of the equation, what you're left with is that same portfolio. That's what the active managers divvy up. So an active manager can win, but generally only if another active manager is losing. So It's a silly game to say this is a great environment for active investors or a great environment for passive. The before fee performance of actively managed mutual funds is nearly identical to that of passive. And it always has been, and it always will be. So the key question is, can you choose active managers who are likely to have an edge and whose success will be funded by other active managers whose bets don't work? Look for that in your investing.
Rob, we got to leave it there. Rob Arnott, thank you so much. With Research Affiliates, and I really can't say the uniqueness of his research energy, no one has done more in securities research over a longer time than Rob Arnott. Check out so much of his work with the CFA program in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Joining us now, always lecturing on Econ 101, Francis Donald, Global Chief Economist and Strategist at Manulife of Canada and America. Francis, good to see you again. Let me cut to the chase. We have a Fed in action. They are wildly ex post. What is the data after the fact that matters?
There's a lot of data that matters, but I suspect we're going to be moving away from the traditional, what is GDP, what is the unemployment rate, what is CPI? We're going to have to get a lot deeper moving forward. And that's because, well, the nature of growth and how the slowdown is impacting the economy is likely to be uneven. Yes, we are probably going to see a lower unemployment rate than we have in past slowdowns or recessions, but the composition of it will matter. Yeah. For example, during COVID, we had, you know, millions and millions of job losses, but they were in low-wage jobs that didn't hit GDP. In the coming, we might see those tech and finances having a larger impact. And inflation will be problematic because it's not about the headline number anymore. It's going to be about what segment of remaining inflation is interest rate sensitive or not. So unfortunately, that level one data is not going to be enough to tell the story or what the Fed's going to do anymore. We're going to have to work a little bit harder in 2023.
Explain the goods, services partition of inflation. Explain those two vectors as we look at the vectors to March.
Well, this one in some ways is straightforward. We know the unwind from COVID is going to push down on the goods side and services where you have that remaining component. But I'm looking a little bit further than that, which is right now we still have inflation that is interest rate sensitive. It matters. We're really pulling down on that excess savings, the demand side of the equation. But it's not so much goods and services that keeps me up at night. It's supply versus demand. And when we get to later this year, how is the Fed going to be combating the remaining inflation, which is food price inflation centric or geopolitical driven or ESG driven? We're going to have a moment, not just from the Fed, but from global central bankers. And I think it's going to start this year where they have to admit their ability to control that CPI number is waning, both on a cyclical factor in this year and next, but also on a structural basis.
And Francis, with that in mind, when they say we want to get sufficiently restrictive, what does that mean?
Your guess is as good as mine, John, but I think what they're looking for is more balance in the economy. And of course, they are getting it. They got a lot of it in 2022. Here we are talking about what does the landing look like? I'm looking backwards at 2022 and saying that looked like a landing to me. We had significant drawdown in housing, a bear market in the S&P. Did that not qualify as the significant slowdown? Now we're looking down. We're saying we're landed. The question is, do we hit the wall at the end of this runway? That's what we're focusing on moving forward.
What is the wall at the end of the runway? Recession or the fact that you think they're going to have to accept a higher inflation rate?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of the two of them, but it depends on your timeline. When I look at the wall at the end of the runway, what concerns me actually isn't 2 quarters of negative growth. It hasn't been for the last year. It's this concept of something we've been discussing internally, which puts a pit in my stomach, a concept like rolling recessions. Or when you look back in history, sometimes we see these periods of expansion downturns that fluctuate very quickly. Very difficult to manage money in that type of environment. And if we're heading into a period where GDP is oscillating around zero, slightly above, slightly below, we're going to spend all our time arguing over whether or not it qualifies as a recession or not, not focusing on the big story, which is we are not in reflation. We're much closer to stagflation. We are not in the roaring 20s. We're going to be in a slower growth environment with a lot of particularities that we have not seen in the past.
What is your win on this, Francis? I mean, we had Matt Lazetian from Deutsche Bank, who was brilliant on a delayed recession call. When is the win, not of recession or NBER recession, but what is the win of outright stagflation?
I heard that interview. I thought it was great. And I'm going to agree with Matt that it's towards the end of 2023 is the problem. And especially around June, July, this is when the year-over-year comps for inflation get a little bit trickier. And I'm concerned that's when the momentum in disinflation begins to pause out. And based on our traditional leading indicators of the economy, by the mid to end of 2023, that's when we're probably going to start to see the consumer and the jobs picture begin to decline. But at the same time, Tom, we do have to evaluate those leading indicators. Should we rely on them the same way that we have in the past?
Francis, I want to segue here over to your knowledge of Canadian macroeconomics. What can Jerome Powell learn from the Bank of Canada? I look at select developed nation banks, and they're taking a different path than the Fed. What's a lesson learned from the Bank of Canada for Washington?
Well, here's the challenge. In Canada and in many of the smaller developed economies, you have even less ability to control inflation with your domestic interest rates. And this is what the bigger bind for the Fed going into the next year is, that if you're Australia or Canada, you're at the point where your impact on your economy from higher interest rates becomes much more severe, particularly because of the housing reliance, and your ability to control inflation begins to decline. So when I think about the Fed versus the Bank of Canada, what I see is a problematic situation where the Fed can tighten global financial conditions, but the Bank of Canada cannot. It's going to create a much bigger divide between these central banks moving forward.
I mean, John, this is what it's about. I set her up with that question to go to you. Imagine the Bank of England and what they have to do, or ECB, if Jerome Powell legs it out with inversion of 95, 100 basis points, with the 30-year mortgage going through to new high interest rates, with the Bloomberg Total Return Index moving down in price to under October level. What does that mean for the other banks?
They're all wrestling with similar issues, though. And I think, Francis, you've touched on it. The character of this new economy, that we might face labor hoarding. Can you work a little bit more on that, Francis? Just go through it piece by piece. The post-pandemic labor market realities, what are they, do you think, that just haven't been accepted just yet?
Well, let's keep it simple. Take a look at the employment to population ratio. What percentage of Americans are working? 40% of Americans are not working. Move aside the labor force participation rate and all of its equivalents. We're also looking at an economy where we have fewer people than before the pandemic. We're missing over 2 million workers. Where did they go? A lot of them retired early. A lot of them got fed up with this market. A lot of them are dealing with childcare and health issues. We have not come to the reality yet that our concepts of demand and supply for labor, for wages, may not work the same way our textbooks told us they did for the last several decades. So our new equations on how we evaluate what brings labor back to the market, I think those are going to have to change pretty significantly.
Francis, what is it, do you think, that brings labor back to this market?
Well, we know from history, if you make people poor enough, they will have to go back to work. But is that what we should be doing? And is that what central banks should be doing? And this is the big challenge I have when I hear central banks saying, we're going to reduce demand to bring it back into supply. But when you have supply shocks that are continuous, is really the medicine worth the cure in this particular environment? What is the role of a central bank? Control inflation and employment, or make the lives of the citizens of this country better? This is going to be a problematic question for central banks moving forward.
Francis, I think the next question further down the road, do you think politically that these institutions are going to come into some real trouble once people start to figure out, the electorate starts to figure out, that their vote in the election is perhaps less important than what happens across the road at the Federal Reserve?
Well, we're certainly, I think, already beginning to see the challenges associated there, that when you begin to recognize what impacts your mortgage and how much things cost, that really that's more of a monetary policy question. We're all, not just the general public, but financial services are also going to have a moment where we realize monetary policy dominance, which has ruled so much of the way that we invest money and live our lives, we maybe see that challenging, especially because moving forward, the inflation in the system is likely to become less interest rate sensitive, not more. We're going to have a moment where we come and recognize that central banks need to do it, investors need to do it, eventually the general public will do it too.
Francis, we've missed you. It's good to have you back. And happy birthday for last week, because we didn't get to do this last week. Thank you. Francis Donald, Manulife Investment Management.
It is a joy to bring in Ajay Bryson. He is chief economist at Wells Fargo with a truly international bent. Jay, let me start with a basic idea. Is Jerome Powell the banker to the world? Is he the central banker to the world now in honor of Bill Rhodes?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, I think the, you know, the chairman of the Federal Reserve over the number of years has been the most important banker. Now, is he banker to the world? Is he here to bail out the rest of the world? No, not necessarily, right? They only have really two objectives. That's inflation in the United States and the unemployment rate. But clearly, Federal Reserve is the most important central bank in the world.
My recollection is you memorized the Taylor Rule watching March Madness down at Chapel Hill many, many years ago. I miss this today. One of our previous guests, Jay, had it out how distorted the Taylor Rule is once again. Torsten Slok suggesting up near a 9, even 10% Taylor Rule. What's the Powell Rule right now? What's the equation Jerome Powell's using if the Taylor Rule is busted?
Well, so you think about the Taylor Rule. I mean, there's, you know, two variables in there. Well, one would be inflation, and one would be, you know, the unemployment rate or the gap there, the output gap. And I think there, the overwhelming weight is on inflation right now.
Yeah.
The Fed right now is much more reactionary than forward looking. I mean, if you think back to Jackson Hole a few years ago, I mean, they essentially threw out the forward looking sort of stuff, R-starred and et cetera, et cetera. It's all about where is the economy right now, and they're kind of really trying to feel their way in. But again, it's all about inflation right now. Where all the weight is.
I mean, so much of this is our complete focus on the Fed. Are we going to be doing this all year? I mean, the Fed Derby, the Dots Derby, the Michael McKee Derby, Jay Bryson, are we going to be doing this for the rest of the year?
You know, I think so, Tom. I think it's going to be a high weight on what the Fed is doing. Now, if we get in, a few months from now, and it looks like the economy is really starting to slip, I think what really becomes important there are initial jobless claims and other labor market sort of variables. Right. But for the foreseeable future, I think it's really all about the Fed.
Can we, I'm looking at this almost as domestic final sales, can we quote unquote slip, or can we just say it's the housing market and other financial distortions slipping and the rest of it does pretty well like durable goods just showed? How does that mix play out?
Yeah, so if you think about the consumer right now, the consumer is very, very strong financially. And so you could have a recession this year in, say, manufacturing. Strong dollar, weaker growth in the rest of the world. You could have weakness in the housing market. I mean, that's what we've seen for the last, almost year now. But consumer spending could continue to hold in there. And given the fact that consumer spending is 70% of the economy, you could have a few sectors in the economy in kind of a recession. And the overall economy wouldn't necessarily need to tip into recession.
I mean, that's right where I wanted to go, is you got an NBER recession here. And I note yields coming in abruptly here. Two-year yield into 4.78%, down 3 basis points. 10-year yield migrates away to down 2 basis points with a little bit, just a little bit of curve inversion. I don't want to oversell that. Futures up 30. Jay, I look at the stew, as Lisa would say, that we're in, and to me, I want to, just as you said, partition it. If we slow down, we don't all slow down, do we?
No, that's right. I mean, you know, the economy, you know, there's lots of different sectors in the economy. You think back, Tom, about, you know, back to 2015, 2016, China was having some real problems. The manufacturing sector back then was in a recession. The overall U.S. economy was not in a recession. So you can have different sectors going down and not the whole ship going down. Now, if some of those sectors go down a lot, like manufacturing and housing, and then you start to get job losses in there, then it does start to bleed into other sorts of sectors in the economy. So it's a really tricky situation that the Fed finds itself in right now.
Jay Bryson, to the global footprint, which you commanded for years at Wells Fargo, how urgent is it for IMF right now? I mean, you've got the Nigerian elections and that, but how of a moment is it right now for the International Monetary Fund?
Well, you know, if you look around the world right now, you know, most of the world is slowing down right now. You know, if you look at Europe now, it's not as bad as what it was, say, you know, 6 months ago when energy prices were through the roof over there. You know, fortunately, when you look around the world, there are not signs of big debt bubbles like we had, say, 20 years ago in Asia, places like that, right? So obviously, you know, the IMF is, you know, obviously very, very important institution around the world. But you know, my sense is the overall global economy right now is okay. But, you know, it's obviously the fraught geopolitical situation, potential for lots of different sorts of shocks. And so it's good to have that backstop of the IMF there if, in fact, it's needed.
Jay Bryson, thank you so much for joining us today with Wells Fargo, their chief economist here. I really can't say enough about what their team has done for us here in the ambiguities of the moment.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Joining us now, and I want to do a really more focused discussion here on the distance across what in my ute was the Formosa Strait. Trust me, there's been people from Taiwan over the years, led by Scarlet Fu, that have grabbed me by the bow tie and said, shut up, this is the way it is. Libby Cantrell is expert at looking at the way it is in Washington. She's head of public policy at PIMCO. Libby, I want to get away from the zeitgeist baloney and know that Pelosi made a trip to Taiwan, the former speaker, but other politicians have followed on. What is our relationship with Taiwan right now?
Yeah, well, good morning, Tom. Starting out with the light questions here on a Monday morning. I think the purpose of certainly former Speaker Pelosi and then the delegation that just went actually last week is to, in many ways, I think, send a pretty strong signal to China that the United States will continue to support Taiwan. Now, of course, our policy in terms of strategic ambiguity has not changed in terms of kind of the one China policy. But we are, you know, I think very much sort of sending a signal that should that change, should China in particular do anything to disrupt that very kind of fragile, tenuous relationship, that the United States will will sort of back up Taiwan. And of course, there are some preemptive measures that the United States is taking in terms of providing arms and what have you to make Taiwan sort of a porcupine, so to speak, in terms of being able to defend itself. But again, I think these visits in themselves are you know, very symbolic in terms of sending a signal to China that the United States is monitoring this relationship very closely.
Perfectly said. They're symbolic, except all of a sudden the Secretary of Defense is talking to Mr. Marcos, the younger of the Philippines, about, I believe, four bases over there. And there's relationships with Japan. Do you see in the Republican-Democrat bipartisan debate on China a new Pacific Rim policy of Capitol Hill and Washington?
I think politically, that's quite difficult to do anything formal. Of course, as you know, Tom, the Trans-Pacific Partnership was in some ways trying to get to that, trying to isolate China, at least economically, from a trade perspective. But I do think that sort of a de facto policy is emerging, both from the administration's perspective and also a Capitol Hill perspective, to really try to alienate China, right, or try to isolate China geographically.
John, this is chilling, and that it's a discussion from my youth. It's like a warp back to, I'm guessing off the top of my head, 72.
Well, there was a hope we'd left some of this behind, Tom, but it's back on the agenda in so many different ways.
Yes, you're very well said today.
Thank you. You're well said too. You're doing great.
You are well said.
Libby, I want to go to a publication in Germany that came out with a report last week that a Chinese manufacturer was in discussions with Russia to sell them drones. Libby, the United States and the administration have been very transparent about the intelligence they've been receiving. They say it's a risk. We want to understand what the consequences might be. Libby, what do you have in mind if that did so happen?
Yeah, and I mean, I think, John, you're exactly right that the administration is really trying to be as sort of transparent and forthcoming here in terms of their warnings to China. Of course, it doesn't seem like we have intelligence that they are providing military or lethal aid to Russia, but a pretty stark warning from Secretary of State Blinken and other folks that if they should, that there will be consequences. In terms of those consequences, John, there are secondary sanctions. That has been something sort of on the tip of the tongue of many members of Congress really since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and a sort of this view that China has been, kind of complicit in all of this. So I think secondary sanctions would absolutely be on the table. And then more export controls. Of course, we saw the administration move forward with pretty punitive export controls, pretty focused, however, on advanced semiconductor chips. But that could also expand to other sectors should there be intelligence that China is providing lethal aid to Russia. Of course, there isn't that yet. We should just clarify. But if that should come to sort of public light, I think that Congress in particular will move forward pretty quickly on this.
Libby, can we talk about a couple of cross currents at the moment then? So the administration seems to be on the same page as Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, when it comes to containing, say, the competitiveness, the economic threat that maybe the Chinese Communist poses. At the same time, we seem to have this fraying when it comes to supporting Ukraine and the military effort in Ukraine within Washington, D.C. If we put all of that together, and let's say we face the very real probability of ending up in a proxy war with China in Ukraine, what would support look like in Congress to continue funding the military effort of Ukraine against Russia?
Yeah, I mean, I think just to be clear, I don't think the administration wants this to be a proxy war at all. And I would say, John, that although there have, of course, been a lot of media reports about the softening support, especially among Republicans in terms of supporting Ukraine, I think that's a bit overstated. I would contend that the center has very much held in terms of the support for Ukraine. You had Minority Leader Mitch McConnell very emphatically saying that the support for Ukraine will continue. That may come with more conditions, a little bit more oversight from this Republican House in particular. But I think we should not, the point here is that there is a lot of congressional support for Ukraine, regardless of what happens with China. And then, of course, right, if it does devolve into a proxy war, which, again, I don't think anybody wants, particularly in the administration, I think you'll continue to see even more support.
Libby, quick question, Sharp Sagui, if I may. In the headlines of the papers today is this never-ending legal debate on student loans. Has that engaged Washington, or is that a story that's off the radar?
No, I think it's very much engaged Washington. It's also a really important issue for a lot of Democratic voters in particular, a lot of young voters more broadly. So I think a lot of folks are going to be watching this. You know, I think, our view has been that the legal justification for the student loan cancellation was a bit tenuous. Even former Speaker Pelosi had said that Congress needed to do it. And Joe Biden had said that at one point as well, that it was actually in Congress's remit, not the administration. So, I think we would be surprised if the court sided with the administration. But of course, a court decision probably is not going to come until, next year, sort of later this year, excuse me. We'll have to see. But yes, I think that lots of people will be paying attention to those arguments this week in front of the Supreme Court.
Libby, this was nice. It's been too long. You notice how Libby's been avoiding us. Have you noticed that?
Hardly. Come on, John. Never. Never, guys.
We've got to make this happen more.
I'd rather you be talking about the Denver Broncos, though, than these,
Well, we've been ordered.
Next
we can't
time.
Do that. It's so depressing that, we can't.
Hey, Libby, thank you. Broncos. Libby Cantor there of PIMCO.
Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern. On Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.